and people all over the world will read your stories. Oh, you exaggerate, Hassan, I said, loving him for it. No, you will be great and famous, he insisted. Then he paused, as if on the verge of adding something. He weighed his words and cleared his throat. But will you permit me to ask a question about the story? He said shyly. Of course. Well, he started, broke off. Tell me, Hassan, I said. I smiled, though suddenly the insecure writer in me wasn't so sure he wanted to hear it. Well, he said, if I may ask, why did the man kill his wife? In fact, why did he ever have to feel sad to shed tears? Couldn't he have just smelled an onion? I was stunned. That particular point, so obvious it was utterly stupid, hadn't even occurred to me. I moved my lips soundlessly. It appeared that on the same night I had learned about one of writing's objectives, irony, I would also be introduced to one of its pitfalls, the plot hole, taught by Hassan, of all people. Hassan, who couldn't read and had never written a single word in his entire life. A voice, cold and dark, suddenly whispered in my ear. What does he know, that illiterate Hazara? He'll never be anything but a cook. How dare he criticize you? Well, I began. But I never got to finish that sentence, because suddenly Afghanistan changed forever. Something roared like thunder. The earth shook a little, and we heard the rat-tat-tat of gunfire. Father! Hassan cried. We sprung to our feet and raced out of the living room. We found Ali hobbling frantically across the foyer. Father, what's that sound? Hassan yelped, his hands outstretched toward Ali. Ali wrapped his arms around us. A white light flashed, lit the sky in silver. It flashed again, was followed by a rapid staccato of gunfire. They're hunting ducks, Ali said in a hoarse voice. They hunt ducks at night, you know. Don't be afraid. A siren went off in the distance. Somewhere a glass shattered and someone shouted. I heard people on the street, jolted from sleep and probably still in their pajamas, with ruffled hair and puffy eyes. Hassan was crying. Ali pulled him close, clutched him with tenderness. Later, I would tell myself I hadn't felt envious of Hassan. Not at all. We stayed huddled that way until the early hours of the morning. The shootings and explosions had lasted less than an hour, but they had frightened us badly, because none of us had ever heard gunshots in the streets. They were foreign sounds to us then. The generation of Afghan children whose ears would know nothing but the sounds of bombs and gunfire was not yet born. Huddled together in the dining room and waiting for the sun to rise, none of us had any notion that a way of life had ended, our way of life. If not quite yet, then at least it was the beginning of the end. The end, the official end, would come first in April of 1978 with the communist coup d'etat, and then in December of 1979, with Russian tanks would roll into the very same streets where Hassan and I played, bringing the death of the Afghanistan I knew and marking the start of a still ongoing era of bloodletting. Just before sunrise, Baba's car peeled into the driveway. His door slammed shut and his running footsteps pounded the stairs. Then he appeared in the doorway and I saw something on his face. Something I didn't recognize right away because I'd never seen it before. Fear. Amir, Hassan! He exclaimed as he ran to us, opening his arms wide. They blocked all the roads and the telephone didn't work. I was so worried. We let him wrap us in his arms. And for a brief, insane moment, I was glad about whatever had happened that night. They weren't shooting ducks after all. As it turned out, they hadn't shot much of anything that night of July 17, 1973. Kabul awoke the next morning to find that the monarchy was a thing of the past. The king, Zahir Shah, was away in Italy. In his absence, his cousin Dawood Khan had ended the king's 40-year reign with a bloodless coup. I remember Hassan and I crouching that next morning outside my father's study, as Baba and Rahim Khan sipped black tea and listened to breaking news of the coup on Radio Kabul. Amiroga, Hassan whispered.
What?
What's a republic? I shrugged.
I don't know.
On Baba's radio, they were saying that word, republic, over and over again.
Amiroga.
What?
Does republic mean father and I will have to move away?
I don't think so, I whispered back. Hassan considered this.
Amiroga.
What?
I don't want them to send father and me away.
I smiled.
Pass you, donkey. No one's sending you away.
Amiroga?
What?
Do you want to go climb our tree? My smile broadened. That was another thing about Hassan. He always knew when to say the right thing. The news on the radio was getting pretty boring.
Hassan went to his shack to get ready, and I ran upstairs to grab a book. Then I went to the kitchen, stuffed my pockets with handfuls of pine nuts, and ran outside to find Hassan waiting for me. We burst through the front gates and headed for the hill. We crossed a residential street and were trekking through a barren patch of rough land that led to the hill when suddenly a rock struck Hassan in the back. We whirled around and my heart dropped. Asif and two of his friends, Wali and Kamal, were approaching us. Asif was the son of one of my father's friends, Mahmoud, an airline pilot. His family lived a few streets south of our home, in a posh, high-walled compound with palm trees. If you were a kid living in the Wazir Akbar Khan section of Kabul, you knew about Asif and his famous stainless steel brass knuckles, hopefully not through personal experience. Born to a German mother and Afghan father, the blonde, blue-eyed Asif towered over the other kids. His well-earned reputation for savagery preceded him on the streets. Flanked by his obeying friends, he walked the neighborhood like a Khan strolling through his land with his eager to please entourage. His word was law, and if you needed a little legal education, then those brass knuckles were just the right teaching tool. I saw him use those knuckles once on a kid from the Karte Char district. I will never forget how Asif's blue eyes glinted with a light not entirely sane, and how he grinned, as he pummeled that poor kid unconscious. Some of the boys in Wazir Akbar Khan had nicknamed him Asif Goshkhor, or Asif the Ear Eater. Of course, none of them dared utter it to his face unless the wish to suffer the same fate as the poor kid who had unwittingly inspired that nickname when he had fought Asif over a kite and ended up fishing his right ear from a muddy gutter. Years later, I learned an English word for the creature that Asif was, a word for which a good Farsi equivalent does not exist: sociopath. Of all the neighborhood boys who tortured Ali, Asif was by far the most relentless. He was, in fact, the originator of the Babalu jeer. Hey, Babalu, who did you eat today? Huh? Come on, Babalu, give us a smile. And on days when he felt particularly inspired, he spiced up his badgering a little. Hey, you flat-nosed Babalu, who did you eat today? Tell us, you slant-eyed donkey. Now he was walking toward us, hands on his hips, his sneakers kicking up little puffs of dust. Good morning, Coonies, Asif exclaimed, waving. Fag. That was another of his favorite insults. Hassan retreated behind me as the three older boys closed in. They stood before us, three tall boys dressed in jeans and t-shirts. Towering over us all, Asif crossed his thick arms on his chest, a savage sort of grin on his lips. Not for the first time, it occurred to me that Asif might not be entirely sane. It also occurred to me how lucky I was to have Baba as my father, the sole reason, I believe, Asif had mostly refrained from harassing me too much. He tipped his chin to Hassan. Hey, flatnose, he said. How's Babalu? Hassan said nothing and crept another step behind me. Have you heard the news, boys? Asif said, his grin never faltering. The king is gone. Good riddance. Long live the president. My father knows Dawood Khan. Did you know that, Amir? So does my father, I said. In reality, I had no idea if that was true or not. So does my father, Asif mimicked me in a whining voice. Kamal and Ali cackled in unison. I wished Baba were there. Well, Dawood Khan dined at our house last year, Asif went on. How do you like that, Amir? I wondered if anyone would hear a scream in this remote patch of land. Baba's house was a good kilometer away. I wish we'd stayed at the house.
Do you know what I will tell Dawood Khan the next time he comes to our house for dinner?
Asif said.
I'm going to have a little chat with him, man to man, mard to mard. Tell him what I told my mother about Hitler. Now there was a leader, a great leader, a man with vision. I'll tell Dawood Khan to remember that if they had let Hitler finish what he'd started, the world would be a better place now.
Baba says Hitler was crazy, that he ordered a lot of innocent people killed, I heard myself say before I could clamp a hand on my mouth.
Asif snickered. He sounds like my mother, and she's German. She should know better.
But then they want you to believe that, don't they? They don't want you to know the truth.
I didn't know who they were or what truth they were hiding, and I didn't want to find out. I wished I hadn't said anything. I wished again I'd look up and see Baba coming up the hill.
But you have to read books they don't give out in school, Asif said.
I have, and my eyes have been opened. Now I have a vision, and I'm going to share it with our new president. Do you know what it is?
I shook my head.
He'd tell me anyway. Asif always answered his own questions.
His blue eyes flicked to Hassan.
Afghanistan is the land of Pashtuns. It always has been, always will be. We are the true Afghans, the pure Afghans, not this flat nose here. His people pollute our homeland, our watan. They dirty our blood.
He made a sweeping, grandiose gesture with his hands.
Afghanistan for Pashtuns, I say. That's my vision.
Asif shifted his gaze to me again. He looked like someone coming out of a good dream.
Too late for Hitler, he said, but not for us.
He reached for something from the back pocket of his jeans.
I'll ask the president to do what the king didn't have the quwwat to do, to rid Afghanistan of all the dirty Kasif Hazaras.
Just let us go, Asif, I said, hating the way my voice trembled. We're not bothering you.
Oh, you're bothering me, Asif hissed.
And I saw with a sinking heart what he had fished out of his pocket.
Of course.
His stainless steel brass knuckles sparkled in the sun.
You're bothering me very much. In fact, you bother me more than this Hazara here.
How can you talk to him, play with him, let him touch you? He said, his voice dripping with disgust.
Wali and Kamal nodded and grunted in agreement.
Asif narrowed his eyes, shook his head. When he spoke again, he sounded as baffled as he looked.
How can you call him your friend?
But he's not my friend, I almost blurted. He's my servant.
Had I really thought that?
Of course I hadn't. I hadn't. I treated Hassan well, just like a friend, better even, more like a brother.
But if so, then why, when Baba's friends came to visit with their kids, didn't I ever include Hassan in our games?
Why did I play with Hassan only when no one else was around?
Asif slipped on the brass knuckles, gave me an icy look.
You're part of the problem, Amir. If idiots like you and your father didn't take these people in, we'd be rid of them by now. They'd all just go rot in Hazarajat where they belong. You're a disgrace to Afghanistan.
I looked in his crazy eyes and saw that he meant it. He really meant to hurt me.
Asif raised his fist and came for me.
There was a flurry of rapid movement behind me. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Hassan bend down and stand up quickly.
Asif's eyes flicked to something behind me and widened with surprise.
I saw that same look of astonishment on Kamal and Wali's faces as they too saw what had happened behind me.
I turned and came face to face with Hassan's slingshot.
Hassan had pulled a white elastic band all the way back. In the cup was a rock the size of a walnut. Hassan held the slingshot pointed directly at Asif's face. His hand trembled with the strain of the pulled elastic band, and beads of sweat had erupted on his brow.
Please leave us alone, Aga, Hassan said in a flat tone.
He'd referred to Asif as Aga, and I wondered briefly what it must be like to live with such an ingrained sense of one's place in a hierarchy.
Asif gritted his teeth.
Put it down, you motherless Hazara.
Please leave us be, Aga, Hassan said.
Asif smiled.
Maybe he didn't notice, but there are three of us and two of you.
Hassan shrugged.
To an outsider, he didn't look scared. But Hassan's face was my earliest memory, and I knew all of its subtle nuances, knew each and every twitch and flicker that ever rippled across it, and I saw that he was scared. He was scared, plenty.
You're right, Aga, but perhaps you didn't notice that I'm the one holding the slingshot. If you make a move, they'll have to change your nickname from Osef the Ear Eater to One-Eyed Osef, because I have this rock pointed at your left eye.
He said this so flatly that even I had to strain to hear the fear that I knew hid under that calm voice.
Osef's mouth twitched.
Wali and Kamal watched this exchange with something akin to fascination. Someone had challenged their god, humiliated him, and worst of all, that someone was a skinny Hazara.
Osef looked from the rock to Hassan.
He searched Hassan's face intently. What he found in it must have convinced him of the seriousness of Hassan's intentions, because he lowered his fist.
You should know something about me, Hazara, Osef said gravely. I'm a very patient person. This doesn't end today, believe me.
He turned to me.
This isn't the end for you either, Amir. Someday, I'll make you face me one-on-one.
Osef retreated a step. His disciples followed.
Your Hazara made a big mistake today, Amir, he said.
Then they turned around, walked away. I watched them walk down the hill and disappear behind the wall. Hassan was trying to tuck the slingshot in his waist with a pair of trembling hands. His mouth curled up into something that was supposed to be a reassuring smile. It took him 5 tries to tie the string of his trousers.
Neither one of us said much of anything as we walked home in trepidation, certain that Osef and his friends would ambush us every time we turned a corner.
They didn't, and that should have comforted us a little. But it didn't. Not at all.
For the next couple of years, the words economic development and reform danced on a lot of lips in Kabul. The antiquated monarchy system had been abolished, replaced by a modern republic led by a president of the republic. A sense of rejuvenation and purpose swept across the land. People spoke of women's rights and modern technology. And for the most part, even though a new leader lived in Arg, the royal palace in Kabul, life went on as before. People went to work Saturday through Thursday and gathered for picnics on Fridays in parks on the banks of Arka Lake in the gardens of Parman. Multicolored buses and lorries filled with passengers rolled through the narrow streets of Kabul, led by the constant shouts of the driver assistants who straddled the vehicle's rear bumpers and yelped directions to the driver in their thick Kabuli accent. On Eid, the 3 days of celebration after the holy month of Ramadan, Kabulis dressed in their best and newest clothes and visited their families. People hugged and kissed and greeted each other with Eid Mubarak, Happy Eid. Children opened gifts and played with dyed hard-boiled eggs. Early that following winter of 1974, Hassan and I were playing in the yard one day, building a snow fort, when Ali called him in.
Hassan, Al-Saib wants to talk to you.
He was standing by the front door, dressed in white, hands tucked under his armpits, breath puffing from his mouth. Hassan and I exchanged a smile. We'd been waiting for this call all day. It was Hassan's birthday.
What is it, father? Do you know? Will you tell us?
Hassan said. His eyes were gleaming.
Ali shrugged. Aga Saib hasn't discussed it with me.
Come on, Ali, tell us, I pressed. Is it a drawing book? Maybe a new pistol?
Like Hassan, Ali was incapable of lying. Every year, he pretended not to know what Baba had bought Hassan or me for our birthdays. And every year, his eyes betrayed him, and we coaxed the goods out of him. This time, though, it seemed he was telling the truth.
Baba never missed Hassan's birthday. For a while, he used to ask Hassan what he wanted, but he gave up doing that because Hassan was always too modest to actually suggest a present. So every winter, Baba picked something out himself. He bought him a Japanese toy truck one year, an electric locomotive and train track set another year. The previous year, Baba had surprised Hassan with a leather cowboy hat, just like the one Clint Eastwood wore in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which had unseated The Magnificent Seven as our favorite Western. That whole winter, Hassan and I took turns wearing the hat and belted out the film's famous music
as we climbed mounds of snow and shot each other dead. We took off our gloves and removed our snow-laden boots at the front door. When we stepped into the foyer, we found Baba sitting by the wood-burning cast-iron stove with a short, balding Indian man dressed in a brown suit and red tie.
"Hassan," Baba said, smiling coyly, "meet your birthday present."
Hassan and I traded blank looks. There was no gift-wrapped box in sight, no bag, no toy. Just Ali standing behind us, and Baba with this slight Indian fellow who looked a little like a mathematics teacher. The Indian man in the brown suit smiled and offered Hassan his hand.
"I am Dr. Kumar," he said. "It's a pleasure to meet you."
He spoke Farsi with a thick, rolling Hindi accent.
"Salam alaikum," Hassan said uncertainly.
He gave a polite tip of the head, but his eyes sought his father behind him. Ali moved closer and set his hand on Hassan's shoulder. Baba met Hassan's wary and puzzled eyes.
"I've summoned Dr. Kumar from New Delhi. Dr. Kumar is a plastic surgeon."
"Do you know what that is?" the Indian man, Dr. Kumar, said. Hassan shook his head. He looked to me for help, but I shrugged. All I knew was that you went to a surgeon to fix you when you had appendicitis. I knew this because one of my classmates had died of it the year before, and the teacher told us they had waited too long to take him to a surgeon. We both looked at Ali, but of course with him, you could never tell. His face was impassive as ever, though something sober had melted into his eyes.
"Well," Dr. Kumar said, "my job is to fix things on people's bodies, sometimes their faces."
"Oh," Hassan said. He looked from Dr. Kumar to Baba to Ali. His hand touched his upper lip, tapped it. "Oh," he said again.
"Well, it's an unusual present, I know," Baba said, "and probably not what you had in mind, but this present will last you forever."
"Oh," Hassan said. He licked his lips, cleared his throat.
"Aga Sahib, will it...
"Nothing doing," Dr. Kumar intervened, smiling kindly. "It will not hurt you one bit. In fact, I will give you a medicine and you will not remember a thing."
"Oh," Hassan said.
He smiled back with relief. A little relief, anyway.
"Oh, I wasn't scared, Aga Sahib. I just..."
Hassan might have been fooled, but I wasn't. I knew that when doctor said it wouldn't hurt, that's when you knew you were in trouble. With dread, I remembered my circumcision the year before. The doctor had given me the same line, reassured me how it wouldn't hurt one bit. But when the numbing medicine wore off later that night, it felt like someone had pressed a red-hot coal to my loins. Why Baba waited until I was 10 to have me circumcised was beyond me, and one of the things I will never forgive him for.
"Happy birthday," Baba said, tussling Hassan's shaved head.
Dr. Kumar had receded a step and was watching us with a trained, polite smile. I smiled along with everybody, but wished I, too, had some kind of scar that would beget Baba's sympathy. It wasn't fair. Hassan hadn't done anything to earn Baba's affections. He'd just been born with that stupid hair lip. The surgery went well. We were all a little shocked when they first removed the bandages, but kept our smiles on just as Dr. Kumar had instructed us. It wasn't easy because Hassan's upper lip was a grotesque mesh of swollen, raw tissue. I expected Hassan to cry with horror when the nurse handed him the mirror. Ali held his hand as Hassan took a long, thoughtful look into it. He muttered something I didn't understand. I put my ear to his mouth. He whispered it again.
"Tashakkur."
"Thank you." Then his lips twisted, and that time I knew just what he was doing. He was smiling, just as he had emerging from his mother's womb. The swelling subsided and the wound healed with time. Soon, it was just a pink jagged line running up from his lip. By the following winter, it was only a faint scar, which was ironic, because that was the winter that Hassan stopped smiling. Winter. Here is what I do on the first day of snowfall every year. I step out of the house early in the morning, still in my pajamas, hugging my arms against the chill. I find the driveway, my father's car, the walls, the trees, the rooftops, and the hills buried under a foot of snow. I smile. The sky is seamless and blue, the snow so white, my eyes burn. I shovel a handful of fresh snow into my mouth. Listen to the muffled stillness, broken only by the cawing of crows. I walk down the front steps, barefoot, and call for Hassan to come out and see. Winter was every kid's favorite season in Kabul, at least those whose fathers could afford to buy a good iron stove. The reason was simple. They shut down school for the icy season. Winter to me was the end of long division and naming the capital of Bulgaria, and the start of 3 months of playing cards by the stove with Hassan, free Russian movies on Tuesday mornings at Cinema Park, sweet turnip korma over rice for lunch after a morning of building snowmen. And kites, of course. Flying kites. And running them. For a few unfortunate kids, winter did not spell the end of the school year. They were the so-called voluntary winter courses. No kid I knew ever volunteered to go to these classes. Parents, of course, did the volunteering for them. Fortunately for me, Baba wasn't one of them. I remember one kid, Ahmad, who lived across the street from us. His father was some kind of doctor, I think. Ahmad had epilepsy and always wore a wool vest and thick black-rimmed glasses. He was one of Asef's regular victims. Every morning, I watched from my bedroom window as their Hazara servant shoveled snow from the driveway, cleared the way for the black opal. I made a point of watching Ahmad and his father get into the car. Ahmad in his wool vest and winter coat, his school bag filled with books and pencils. I waited until they pulled away, turned a corner, then I slipped back into bed in my flannel pajamas. I pulled the blanket to my chin and watched the snow-capped hills in the north through the window. Watched them until I drifted back to sleep. I loved wintertime in Kabul. I loved it for the soft pattering of snow against my window at night. For the way fresh snow crunched under my black rubber boots. For the warmth of the cast iron stove as the wind screeched through the yards and the streets. But mostly because, as the trees froze and ice covered the roads, the chill between Baba and me thawed a little. And the reason for that was the kites. Baba and I lived in the same house, but in different spheres of existence. Kites were the one paper-thin slice of intersection between those spheres. Every winter, districts in Kabul held a kite-fighting tournament. And if you were a boy living in Kabul, the day of the tournament was undeniably the highlight of the cold season. I never slept the night before the tournament. I'd roll from side to side, make shadow animals on the wall, even sit on the balcony in the dark, a blanket wrapped around me. I felt like a soldier trying to sleep in the trenches the night before a major battle, and that wasn't so far off. In Kabul, fighting kites was a little like going to war. As with any war, you had to ready yourself for battle. For a while, Hassan and I used to build our own kites. We saved our weekly allowances in the fall and dropped the money in a little porcelain horse Baba had brought one time from Herat. When the winds of winter began to blow and snow fell in chunks, we undid the snap under the horse's belly. We went to the bazaar and bought bamboo, glue, string, and paper. We spent hours every day shaving bamboo for the center and crossbars, cutting the thin tissue paper which made for easy dipping and recovery. And then, of course, we had to make our own string, or tar. If the kite was the gun, then tar, the glass-coated cutting line, was the bullet in the chamber. We'd go out in the yard and feed up to 500 feet of string through a mixture of ground glass and glue. We'd then hang the line between the trees and leave it to dry. The next day, we'd wind a battle-ready line around the wooden spool. By the time the snow melted and the rains of spring swept in, every boy in Kabul bore telltale horizontal gashes on his fingers from a whole winter of fighting kites. I remember how my classmates and I used to huddle, compare our battle scars on the first day of school. The cuts stung and didn't heal for a couple of weeks, but I didn't mind. They were reminders of a beloved season that had once again passed too quickly. Then the class captain would blow his whistle and we'd march in a file to our classrooms, longing for winter already, greeted instead by the specter of yet another long school year. But it quickly became apparent that Hassan and I were better kite fighters than kite makers. Some flaw or other in our design always spelled its doom. So Baba started taking us to Saifo's to buy our kites. Saifo was a nearly blind old man who was a muchi by profession, a shoe repairman. But he was also the city's most famous kite maker, working out of a tiny hovel on one of Kabul's major streets, Jade Maiwan, south of the muddy banks of the Kabul River. I remember you had to crouch to enter the prison cell-sized store, and then had to lift a trapdoor to creep down a set of wooden steps to the dank basement where Saifo stored his coveted kites. Baba would buy us each three identical kites and spools of glass string. If I changed my mind and asked for a bigger and fancier kite, Baba would buy it for me, but then he'd buy it for Hassan too. Sometimes I wished he wouldn't do that. I wished he'd let me be the favorite. The kite fighting tournament was an old winter tradition in Afghanistan. It started early in the morning on the day of the contest and didn't end until only the winning kite flew in the sky. I remember one year the tournament outlasted daylight. People gathered on sidewalks and roofs to cheer for their kids. The streets filled with kite fighters, jerking and tugging on their lines, squinting up to the sky, trying to gain position to cut the opponent's line. Every kite fighter had an assistant, in my case Hassan, who held the spool and fed the line. One time, a bratty Hindi kid whose family had recently moved into the neighborhood told us that, in his hometown, kite fighting had strict rules and regulations. "You have to play in a boxed area, and you have to stand at a right angle to the wind," he said proudly. "And you can't use aluminum to make a glass string." Hassan and I looked at each other and cracked up. The Hindi kid would soon learn what the British learned earlier in the century and what the Russians would eventually learn by the late 1980s, that Afghans are an independent people. Afghans cherish custom but uphold rules. And so it was with kite fighting. The rules were simple, no rules. Fly your kite, cut the opponents, and good luck. Except that wasn't all. The real fun began when a kite was cut. That was where the kite runners came in. Those kids who chased the windblown kite drifting through the neighborhoods until it came spiraling down in a field, dropping in someone's yard, on a tree, or a rooftop. The chase got pretty fierce. Hordes of kite runners swarmed the streets, shoved past each other like those people from Spain I'd read about once, the ones who ran from the bulls. One year, an Uzbek boy climbed a pine tree for a kite. A branch snapped under his weight and he fell 30 feet, broke his back, and never walked again. But he fell with a kite still in his hands. And when a kite runner had his hands on a kite, no one could take it from him. That wasn't a rule. That was custom. For kite runners, the most coveted prize was the last fallen kite of a winter tournament. It was a trophy of honor, something to be displayed on a mantle for guests to admire. When the sky cleared of kites and only the final two remained, every kite runner readied himself for the chance to land this prize. He positioned himself at a spot that he thought would give him a head start. Tense muscles readied themselves to uncoil. Necks craned, eyes crinkled, fights broke out. And when the last kite was cut, all hell broke loose. Over the years, I'd seen a lot of guys run kites, but Hassan was by far the greatest kite runner I'd ever seen. It was downright eerie the way he always got to the spot the kite would land before the kite did, as if he had some sort of inner compass. I remember one overcast winter day, Hassan and I were running a kite. I was chasing him through the neighborhoods, hopping gutters, weaving through narrow streets. I was a year older than him, but Hassan ran faster than I did, and I was falling behind. "Hassan, wait!" I yelled, my breathing hot and ragged. He whirled around, motioned with his hand. "This way!" he called, before dashing around another corner. I looked up and saw that the direction we were running was opposite to the one the kite was drifting. "We're losing it! We're going the wrong way!" I cried out. "Trust me!" I heard him call up ahead. I reached the corner and saw Hassan bolting along, his head down, not even looking at the sky, sweat soaking through the back of his shirt. I tripped over a rock and fell. I wasn't just slower than Hassan, but clumsier too. I'd always envied his natural athleticism. When I staggered to my feet, I caught a glimpse of Hassan disappearing around another street corner. I hobbled after him, spikes of pain battering my scraped knees. I saw we had ended up on a rutted dirt road near Istiqlal Middle School. There was a field on one side where lettuce grew in the summer and a row of sour cherry trees on the other. I found Hassan sitting cross-legged at the foot of one of the trees, eating from a fistful of dried mulberries. "What are we doing here?" I panted, my stomach roiling with nausea. He smiled. "Sit with me, Amir Agha." I dropped next to him, lay on a thin patch of snow, wheezing. "You're wasting our time. It was going the other way, didn't you see?" Hassan popped the mulberry in his mouth. "It's coming," he said. I could hardly breathe, and he didn't even sound tired. "How do you know?" I said. "I know." "How can you know?" He turned to me. A few sweat beads rolled from his bald scalp. "Would I ever lie to you, Amir Agha?" Suddenly, I decided to toy with him a little. "I don't know. Would you?" "I'd sooner eat dirt," he said with a look of indignation. "Really? You'd do that?" He threw me a puzzled look. "Do what?" "Eat dirt if I told you to," I said. I knew I was being cruel, like when I'd taunt him if he didn't know some big word. But there was something fascinating, albeit in a sick way, about teasing Hassan. Kind of like when we used to play insect torture. Except now, he was the ant, and I was holding the magnifying glass. His eyes searched my face for a long time. We sat there, two boys under a sour cherry tree, suddenly looking, really looking at each other. And that's when it happened again. Hassan's face changed. Maybe not changed, not really. But suddenly, I had the feeling I was looking at two faces. The one I knew, the one that was my first memory, and another, a second face, this one lurking just beneath the surface. I'd seen it happen before. It always shook me up a little. It just appeared, this other face, for a fraction of a moment, long enough to leave me with the unsettling feeling that maybe I'd seen it someplace before. Then Hassan blinked, and it was just him again. Just Hassan. "If you asked, I would," he finally said, looking right at me. I dropped my eyes. To this day, I find it hard to gaze directly at people like Hassan, people who mean every word they say. "But I wonder," he added, "would you ever ask me to do such a thing, Amir Agha?" And just like that, he'd thrown at me his own little test. If I was going to toy with him and challenge his loyalty, then he'd toy with me and test my integrity. I wished I hadn't started this conversation. I forced a smile. "Don't be stupid, Hassan. You know I wouldn't." Hassan returned the smile, except his didn't look forced. "I know," he said. And that's the thing about people who mean everything they say. They think everyone else does too. "Here it comes," Hassan said, pointing to the sky. He rose to his feet and walked a few paces to his left. I looked up, saw the kite plummeting toward us. I heard footfalls, shouts, an approaching melee of kite runners, but they were wasting their time because Hassan stood with his arms wide open, smiling, waiting for the kite. And may God, if he exists, that is, strike me blind if the kite didn't just drop into his outstretched arms. In the winter of 1975, I saw Hassan run a kite for the last time. Usually, each neighborhood held its own competition. But that year, the tournament was going to be held in my neighborhood, Wazir Akbar Khan, and several other districts, Korte Chaur, Korte Parwan, Mikro Rayon, and Kote Sangi had been invited. You could hardly go anywhere without hearing talk of the upcoming tournament. Word had it, This was going to be the biggest tournament in 25 years. One night that winter, with the big contest only 4 days away, Baba and I sat in his study in overstuffed leather chairs by the glow of the fireplace. We were sipping tea, talking. Ali had served dinner earlier, potatoes and curried cauliflower over rice, and had retired for the night with Hassan. Baba was fattening his pipe, and I was asking him to tell the story about the winter a pack of wolves had descended from the mountains in Herat and forced everyone to stay indoors for a week, when he lit a match and said casually, "I think maybe you'll win the tournament this year. What do you think?" I didn't know what to think or what to say. Was that what it would take? Had he just slipped me a key? I was a good kite fighter, actually a very good one. A few times, I'd even come close to winning the winter tournament. Once, I'd made it to the final three, but coming close wasn't the same as winning, was it? Baba hadn't come close. He had won because winners won and everyone else just went home. Baba was used to winning, winning at everything he set his mind to. Didn't he have a right to expect the same from his son? And just imagine, if I did win? Baba smoked his pipe and talked. I pretended to listen, but I couldn't listen, not really, because Baba's casual little comment had planted a seed in my head. The resolution that I would win that winter's tournament. I was going to win. There was no other viable option. I was going to win, and I was going to run that last kite. Then I'd bring it home and show it to Baba. Show him once and for all that his son was worthy. Then maybe my life as a ghost in this house would finally be over. I let myself dream. I imagined conversation and laughter over dinner, instead of silence broken only by the clinking of silverware and the occasional grunt. I envisioned us taking a Friday drive in Baba's car to Parman, stopping on the way to Rakan Lake for some fried trout and potatoes. We'd go to the zoo to see Marjan the lion, and maybe Baba wouldn't yawn and steal looks at his wristwatch all the time. Maybe Baba would even read one of my stories. I'd write him 100 if I thought he'd read one. Maybe he'd call me Amir John, like Rahim Khan did. And maybe, just maybe, I would finally be pardoned for killing my mother. Baba was telling me about the time he'd cut 14 kites on the same day. I smiled and nodded, laughed at all the right places, but I hardly heard a word he said. I had a mission now. I wasn't going to fail Baba, not this time. It snowed heavily the night before the tournament. Hassan and I sat under the kursi and played panchpar as wind-rattled tree branches tapped on the window. Earlier that day, I'd asked Ali to set up the kursi for us, which was basically an electric heater under a low table covered with a thick quilted blanket. Around the table, he arranged mattresses and cushions so as many as 20 people could sit and slip their legs under. Hassan and I used to spend entire snowy days under the kursi, playing chess, cards, mostly panchpar. I killed Hassan's 10 of diamonds and played him 2 jacks and a 6. Next door, in Baba's study, Baba and Rahim Khan were discussing business with a couple of other men. One of them I recognized as Asif's father. Through the wall, I could hear the scratchy sound of Radio Kabul news. Hassan killed the 6 and picked up the jacks. On the radio, Dawood Khan was announcing something about foreign investments. "He says someday we'll have television in Kabul," I said. "Who?" "Dawood Khan, you ass. The president." Hassan giggled. "I heard they already have it in Iran," he said. I sighed. "Oh, those Iranians." For a lot of Hazaras, Iran represented a sanctuary of sorts. I guess because, like Hazaras, most Iranians were Shia Muslims. But I remembered something my teacher said that summer about Iranians, that they were grinning smooth talkers who patted you on the back with one hand and picked your pocket with the other. I told Baba about that, and he said my teacher was one of those jealous Afghans, jealous because Iran was a rising power in Asia, and most people around the world couldn't even find Afghanistan on a world map. It hurts to say that, he said, shrugging. But better to get hurt by the truth than comforted with a lie.
I'll buy you one someday, I said.
Hassan's face brightened.
A television? In truth?
Sure, and not the black and white kind either. We'll probably be grown-ups by then, and I'll buy us two. One for you and one for me.
I'll put it on my table where I keep my drawings, Hassan said.
His saying that made me kind of sad. Sad for who Hassan was and where he lived. For how he'd accepted the fact that he'd grow old in that mud shack in the yard the way his father had. I drew the last card, played him a pair of queens and a ten.
Hassan picked up the queens.
You know, I think you're going to make Aghasai very proud tomorrow.
You think so?
Inshallah, he said.
Inshallah, I echoed, though the God-willing qualifier didn't sound as sincere coming from my lips.
That was the thing with Hassan. He was so goddamn pure, he always felt like a phony around him. I killed his king and played in my final card, the Ace of Spades. He had to pick it up. I had won, but as I shuffled for a new game, I had the distinct suspicion that Hassan had let me win.
Amir Agha?
What?
You know, I like where I live.
He was always doing that, reading my mind. It's my home.
Whatever, I said. Get ready to lose again.
The next morning, as he brewed black tea for breakfast, Hassan told me he'd had a dream. We were at Gharqa Lake, you, me, father, Aghasai, Ibrahim Khan, and thousands of other people, he said. It was warm and sunny, and the lake was clear like a mirror, but no one was swimming because they said a monster had come to the lake. It was swimming at the bottom, waiting. He poured me a cup and added sugar, blew on it a few times, put it before me. So everyone is scared to get in the water, and suddenly you kick off your shoes, Amir Agha, and take off your shirt.
There's no monster, you say. I'll show you all.
And before anyone can stop you, you dive in the water, start swimming away.
I'll follow you in, and we're both swimming.
But you can't swim, I said.
Hassan laughed. It's a dream, Amir Agha. You can do anything.
Anyway, everyone is screaming, get out, get out. But we just swim in the cold water. We make it way out to the middle of the lake and we stop swimming. We turn toward the shore and wave to the people. They look like small ants and we can hear them clapping.
The sea now. There's no monster, just water.
They change the name of the lake after that and call it the Lake of Amir and Hassan, Sultans of Kabul. And we get to charge people money for swimming in it.
So what does it mean? I said.
He coated my naan with marmalade, placed it on a plate.
I don't know. I was hoping you could tell me.
Well, it's a dumb dream. Nothing happens in it. Father says dreams always mean something.
I sipped some tea.
Why don't you ask him then? He's so smart, I said, more curtly than I had intended. I hadn't slept all night. My neck and back were like coiled springs and my eyes stung. Still, I had been mean to Hassan. I almost apologized, then didn't.
Hassan understood I was just nervous.
Hassan always understood about me. Upstairs, I could hear the water running in Baba's bathroom. The streets glistened with fresh snow and the sky was a blameless blue. Snow blanketed every rooftop and weighed on the branches of the stunted mulberry trees that lined our street. Overnight, snow had nudged its way into every crack and gutter. I squinted against the blinding white when Hassan and I stepped through the wrought iron gates. Ali shut the gates behind us. I heard him mutter a prayer under his breath. He always said a prayer when his son left the house. I had never seen so many people on our street. Kids were flinging snowballs, squabbling, chasing one another and giggling. Kite fighters were huddling with the spool holders, making last-minute preparations. From adjacent streets, I could hear laughter and chatter. Already, rooftops were jammed with spectators reclining in lawn chairs, hot tea steaming from thermoses, and the music of Ahmad Zahir blaring from cassette players. The immensely popular Ahmad Zahir had revolutionized Afghan music and outraged the purists by adding electric guitars, drums, and horns to the traditional tabla and harmonium. On stage or at parties, he shirked the austere and nearly morose stance of older singers, and actually smiled when he sang, sometimes even at women. I turned my gaze to our rooftop, found Baba and Rahim Khan sitting on a bench, both dressed in wool sweaters, sipping tea. Baba waved. I couldn't tell if he was waving at me or Hassan. "We should get started," Hassan said. He wore black rubber snow boots and a bright green chapan over a thick sweater and faded corduroy pants. More than ever, he looked like an unfinished Chinese doll. Sunlight washed over his face, and in it, I saw how well the pink scar above his lip had healed. Suddenly, I wanted to withdraw. Pack it all in. Go back home. What was I thinking? Why was I putting myself through this, when I already knew the outcome? Baba was on the roof watching me. I felt his glare on me like the heat of a blistering sun. This would be failure on a grand scale, even for me. "I'm not sure I want to fly a kite today," I said. "It's a beautiful day," Hassan said. I shifted on my feet, tried to peel my gaze away from our rooftop. "I don't know, maybe we should go home." Then he stepped toward me, and in a low voice, said something that scared me a little. "Remember, Amir Agha, there's no monster, just a beautiful day." How could it be such an open book to him when half the time I had no idea what was milling around in his head? I was the one who went to school, the one who could read and write. I was the smart one. Hassan couldn't read a first grade textbook, but he'd read me plenty. That was a little unsettling, but also sort of comfortable to have someone who always knew what you needed. "No monster?" I said, feeling a little better, to my own surprise. He smiled. "No monster." "Are you sure?" He closed his eyes, nodded. I looked at the kids scampering down the street, flinging snowballs. "It is a beautiful day, isn't it?" I said. "Let's fly," he said. It occurred to me that maybe Hassan had made up his dream. Was that possible? I decided it wasn't. Hassan wasn't that smart. I wasn't that smart. But made up or not, the silly dream had lifted some of my anxiety. Maybe I should take off my shirt, take a swim in the lake. Why not? "Let's do it," I said. Hassan's face brightened. "Good." He lifted our kite, red with yellow borders, and just beneath where the central and cross spars met, marked with Sifo's unmistakable signature. He licked his finger and held it up, tested the wind, then ran in its direction. On those rare occasions we flew kites in the summer, he'd kick up dust to see which way the wind blew it. The spool rolled in my hands until Hassan stopped, about 50 feet away. He held the kite high over his head, like an Olympic athlete showing his gold medal. I jerked the string twice, our usual signal, and Hassan tossed the kite. Caught between Baba and the mullahs at school, I still hadn't made up my mind about God. But when a Quran ayat I had learned in my diniyat class rose to my lips, I muttered it. I took a deep breath, exhaled, and pulled on the string. Within a minute, my kite was rocketing to the sky. It made a sound like a paper bird flapping its wings. Hassan clapped his hands, whistled, and ran back to me. I handed him the spool, holding on to the string, and he spun it quickly to roll the loose string back on. At least 2 dozen kites already hung in the sky, like paper sharks roaming for prey. Within an hour, the number doubled, and red, blue, and yellow kites glided and spun in the sky. A cold breeze wafted through my hair. The wind was perfect for kite flying, blowing just hard enough to give some lift and make the sweeps easier. Next to me, Hassan held the spool, his hands already bloodied by the string. Soon the cutting started, and the first of the defeated kites whirled out of control. They fell from the sky like shooting stars with brilliant rippling tails, showering the neighborhoods below with prizes for the kite runners. I could hear the runners now, hollering as they ran the streets. Someone shouted reports of a fight breaking out 2 streets down. I kept stealing glances at Baba sitting with Rahim Khan on the roof and wondered what he was thinking. Was he cheering for me? Or did a part of him enjoy watching me fail? That was the thing about kite flying. Your mind drifted with the kite. They were coming down all over the place now, the kites, and I was still flying. I was still flying. My eyes kept wandering over to Baba, bundled up in his wool coat. Was he surprised that I had lasted as long as I had? You don't keep your eyes to the sky, you won't last much longer, I thought. I snapped my gaze back to the sky. A red kite was closing in on me. I caught it just in time. I tangled a bit with it and ended up besting him when he became impatient and tried to cut me from below. Up and down the streets, kite runners were returning triumphantly, their captured kites held high. They showed them off to their parents and their friends. But they all knew the best was yet to come. The biggest prize of all was still flying. I sliced a bright yellow kite with a coiled white tail. It cost me another gash on the index finger, and blood trickled down into my palm. I had Hassan hold the string and suck the blood dry and blotted my fingers against my jeans. Within another hour, the number of surviving kites dwindled from maybe 50 to a dozen. I was one of them. I had made it to the last dozen. I knew this part of the tournament would take a while, because the guys who had lasted this long were good. They wouldn't easily fall into simple traps like the old lift and dive, Hassan's favorite trick. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, tufts of clouds had drifted in and the sun had slipped behind them. Shadows started to lengthen. The spectators on the roofs bundled up in scarves and thick coats. We were down to a half dozen, and I was still flying. My legs ached and my neck was stiff. But with each defeated kite, hope grew in my heart, like snow collecting on a wall, one flake at a time. My eyes kept returning to a blue kite that had been wreaking havoc for the last hour. "How many has he cut?" I asked. "I counted 11," Hassan said. "Do you know whose it might be?" Hassan clucked his tongue and tipped his chin. That was a trademark Hassan gesture and meant he had no idea. The blue kite sliced a big purple one and swept twice in big loops. 10 minutes later, he'd cut another two, sending hordes of kite runners racing after them. After another 30 minutes, only 4 kites remained, and I was still flying. It seemed I could hardly make a wrong move, as if every gust of wind blew in my favor. I'd never felt so in command, so lucky. It felt intoxicating. I didn't dare look up to the roof. I didn't dare take my eyes off the sky. I had to concentrate and play it smart. Another 15 minutes, and what had seemed like a laughable dream that morning had suddenly become reality. It was just me and the other guy, the blue kite. The tension in the air was as taut as the glass string I was tugging with my bloody hands. People were stomping their feet and clapping, whistling, and chanting. "Buburish! Buburish! Cut him! Cut him!" I wondered if Baba's voice was one of them. Music blasted. The smell of steamed mantou and fried pakora drifted from rooftops and open doors. But all I heard, all I willed myself to hear, was the thudding of blood in my head. All I saw was the blue kite. All I smelled was victory, salvation, redemption. If Baba was wrong, and there was a God, like they said in school, then he'd let me win. I didn't know what the other guy was playing for, maybe just bragging rights. But this was my one chance to become someone who was looked at, not seen, listened to, and not heard. If there was a God, he'd guide the winds and let them blow for me so that, with a tug of my string, I'd cut loose my pain and my longing. I'd endured too much and come too far. And suddenly, just like that, hope became knowledge. I was going to win. It was just a matter of when. It turned out to be sooner than later. A gust of wind lifted my kite and I took advantage. I fed the string and pulled up, looped my kite on top of the blue one. I held position. The blue kite knew it was in trouble. It was trying desperately to maneuver out of the jam, but I didn't let go. I held position. The crowd sensed the end.